Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Peter Paul Verzula, and welcome to the Tuesday, excuse me, I started this bloody cold, the Tuesday new shadow, Amicus Veritas. That theme, which we usually play, the March to the Scaffold, is relevant today because in France in 1939, the last person to be executed by the use of the guillotine, that was... I don't know what he did, but just cropped up on today's events. And all of you Methodists today, this is your patron saint's day. John Wesley was born today. And getting back to France, those of you who like opera, Charles Gounod, the composer of Faust and several other operas, Mirel and that Spanish opera based on the role of... flipped. Anyway, and then those of us who tried to learn shorthand in school, it's the birthday of John Gregg, you know, the Gregg shorthand. And those of you who like your cereal in the morning, this isn't Cheerios, but Wheaties. George Cormack was born today. And then another step forward for civil rights and equal opportunity. For qualified people, James Weldon Johnson. I think he was also a musician. He was the first black lawyer admitted to the Florida Bar. Now, that's not the one you drink, but the the Lawyers Association. And then those of you who love music, and this is interesting, there are many composers who studied law, philosophy, and then dropped it and decided to become composers. And one of them was Igor Stravinsky, the Russian, who wrote his most infamous piece, The Rite of Spring, which was a scandal back in 19, when it premiered in Paris before the war. Other composers who studied law were George Frederick Handel, best known for the Messiah. He wrote many operas, Julius Caesar. Robert Schumann studied law. Peter Tchaikovsky studied law. He was a lawyer, was incompetent, or didn't work out for him. And I think there are several others. And there were also a lot of great musicians and composers and conductors, music conductors, who studied philosophy, like Yasha Horenstein, Wilhelm Furtwängler. And then among the actors, interesting crop, those of you who remember the film Sunrise at Campobello about FDR when he was inflicted with polio, Ralph Bellamy was born in Chicago on this date. And then one of the first lesbian films to come out, The Killing of Sister George. Now, sister, when it's used in the English, British, or Australian, or New Zealand, and even the countries in the British Commonwealth, it means nurse. But this was a lesbian film. Beryl Reed was born today. And then, Killing of Sister George. And then the great author, John Hersey, was born today. And then controversial president of Yale University, Kingman Brewster, was born today. And those of you who like New York schlock, Barry Manilow was born today. And let's see. Okay, and among the deaths, it was Eugene Yuton Weldon. He was the last one who was executed on the guillotine. And then those of you who remember Kate Smith, who could not read music, but she memorized it by ear, and there's several people that do that and have that capability. Kate Smith died today. And then in 1775, we had the Battle of Bunker Hill, which the real name is Breed's Hill. And then Charles Goodyear got the first patent for rubber. Those of you who ride around on Goodyear tires, I guess Michelin's the big one right now, the French one. And then the Republican Party had its first convention in Philadelphia. Travelers Insurance wrote the first accident policy back in 1863. And then on this date in 1940, a surprise to everyone, and we'll be getting in with Charles de Gaulle and others later, France surrendered the government of Paul Reynaud and I forget the other guy's name, Daladier, yeah. And it was surprising because France had the bigger army. The Germans were actually afraid of the French. And, of course, the Germans went around the Maginot Line, and we'll get into that another day. And then this should be a concern to everybody who's looking for a kidney. In 1950, the first kidney transplant was successfully implanted in Chicago, home of the American Medical Association. And nobody knows whether these transplants will be available under if Obamacare or Pelosi Care and Reid Care stands court challenges. And then this brought down a president, Watergate, and there's an analogy with Obamagate. The Watergate burglars were arrested today in 1972, and this led to the resignation of Richard Nixon, probably one of a well-qualified man, but of questionable ethics. He used to say, I didn't do it, but I had others do it for me, words to that effect. And, of course, this is relevant. His incompetence in handling that is equivalent to, in some respects, we see this with the current occupant of the White House, who also should resign. There's a growing number of people who think he's just way in over his head, no pun intended, the oil gusher notwithstanding. And then the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that reading the Bible in school was illegal, and that was banned. Excuse me, I've still got this bloody cold, but we'll survive. And then continuing with our military history, rare history series, we're going to present in a moment the second half of that interview with General Philip Berrigan, the man who was the U.S. General, second in command at Normandy and Mulberry Bridges, and rebuilt the sanitary systems of Western Europe, Belgium, France, Germany after World War II. Then he went to came back to the States and went to work in Chicago on the St. Lawrence Seaway. Now that seaway was a dredging and engineering out work, which permitted seagoing ships to come into the Great Lakes, and that saved the transportation costs. Now, one of the problems was, or there's a question whether, and I asked him this, whether these ships brought in things like lamprey eels, and well, we'll see what he has to say. Here goes. Where is it? Okay, come on. Oh, something's wrong here. Oh, what happened here? Where is... something's wrong here. Come on. It was supposed to, here we go. Play.
Okay. That's prosaic. How did you get involved in the St. Lawrence Seaway Project?
I was in San Francisco, and I had 4 years to do, and I thought I was living in this house, and I thought, I'm going to retire in San Francisco. And the chief calls him up and said, listen, you got decorated by England, France, and Belgium. I have another international job. And I said, what is it? And he says, it's the Niagara Falls, really.
Okay.
And he says, it's a job with Canada, and I want you to go take over the division in Chicago. See, I had the division here that included districts in San Francisco. Now the divisions in Chicago included the Great Lakes, the district in Chicago and Buffalo, and another district up north somewhere.
Northeast?
Northwest, you know, Lake Superior. And it was a very interesting job of remodeling Niagara Falls with the Canadians.
Were they easy to work with?
Oh, terrific. And we both had the same idea. You see, that the international boundary goes right through Niagara Falls. And the falls had all the water going, practically 85% of the water went through the middle quarter of the falls where the international boundary went across. And what we did was to both go on our side of the international boundary and flatten out. We sandbagged, so we got away from the water, but we made the elevation of the edge of where the water would go as the same as the elevation in the middle of the horseshoe. Where
so you had to make it level.
Water to, so that we spread the thing about so that Niagara Falls was maybe instead of a quarter of a mile in the middle of the falls, it was 2 or 3 miles long. And particularly made it very pretty, beautiful. In other words, and we actually generated more power. In other words, we put more power through the powerhouse because all that water is going through the middle of the falls. And for the show, you couldn't divert much more than they were diverting. Whereas if you spread it out for the little bit of water, maybe only 6 inches of water going over the edge, and then diverting more for power, making equal amount of power on the Canadian and the United States side. It was
so for once everything got shared.
Well, it had to be that way. In other words, it's very logical that we wanted it to be that way. It was a fair thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I can get on an environmental thing, General, with the ships, foreign ships coming into through the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Great Lakes, they bring in bacteria and plant life that's not indigenous to the continental United States, and I understand there are problems now. Could that have been avoided?
I don't think that was any different problem from what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
That was the problem of the health department, you might say.
Of course, we weren't that environmentally conscious then, were we?
Well, it wasn't our responsibility. That was something that goes to the public health department.
Mm-hmm.
And
because this is just starting to crop up in being from the Midwest myself, these Russian ships especially, they said, brought in stuff that was not indigenous to the United States, and now they're concerned that these animals will get a foothold here. What did you do after the Seaway?
Gee.
You came back to San Francisco?
No, I can't remember. I should have. I know that was my last job.
Oh, your last major job?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had my last 4 years, and the last two were in Chicago. I had two in San Francisco, where we had Sacramento and Los Angeles, and San Francisco were in the San Francisco division.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in San Francisco's clean water program?
Well, because I was the division engineer here, and this was sort of the Corps of Engineers' responsibility for the federal government part of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand there's a big fuss out in the southeast side, the Hunter's Point area, over the deep tunnel or the deep sewer proposed enclosed program. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we didn't want to dump sewerage into the bay. We wanted to dump it into the ocean, and the treatment plants were San Jose, and
right.
So forth, and we wanted to take the sewage so we got it into the ocean and not in the bay. And that was the reason for, and of course this pipe was, 24 feet in diameter or something. I suppose it's still being used.
Mm-hmm. No.
And, okay. And I think it comes up to San Francisco, and then it goes across San Francisco and out in the ocean, practically at the southern boundary of San Francisco.
Well, I understand there's some political problems, or some of the residents in Hunter's Point are saying that they've got an odor out there, and by building this new project, they'll get rid of this odor coming from the East Bay or that side of the bay.
Well, I think they got the treatment plant there.
Right.
And the sewage is not dumped into the bay, it goes into the ocean. It is piped across San Francisco on the southern boundary to the ocean. The sewage plant sort of tends to be in that end of town.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that was Butchertown, the old meatpacking years ago.
That's right. And, the idea of having a sewage plant in that neighborhood was objectionable. I don't think that you find today that it is too objectionable. There might be some odor there, but I doubt with the way they can treat it, they can with the chemicals and so forth they use, they can make it. Mm-hmm. Very funny, my brother had the same kind of job, except his only job was treating the sewage in Boston. And in some ways it's similar problem, you know, that's a great big bay.
Right, right.
And getting it out into the ocean, yeah.
What was the other project you did in the, you did a project in the East Bay?
Yeah, what do we do?
I think over there in Alameda or Oakland or something?
Yeah, there was a project over there. I can't remember.
That's okay. Okay. I'll find out. Yeah. General, with the drought now, is there any practical advice you could give people, or what can we look forward to?
Pray for rain. No, it's...
Even Hetch Hetchy can't help us?
Huh?
Even Hetch Hetchy?
No, well, there's... No, the rain, if it comes, why, I think we're in a position because it's been so scarce that we're made ourselves in a position to try to save it and not spill it into the ocean as it used to be in ancient times.
What about desalinization of ocean water? What do you think of that?
Well, that's very expensive.
Is it practical, do you think?
Well, you can always do it. You know, in other words, you can get the salt out and you can, but it's not a cheap process.
Could ever the price, the cost factor be brought down?
Oh, I doubt it. You know, it's more than salt. There are all kinds of substances in the ocean,
mm-hmm,
that you have to get out. Whereas rain is as pure as it comes. It's got itself by evaporation into the clouds, and you're trying to imitate what God does with evaporation.
That's a good point, General. General, I suppose you've been following the Iraqi-Kuwait problem. After this is all resolved, whichever at the diplomatic table or on in the desert, will the Army Corps of Engineers go in there and help rebuild Kuwait, or will that be Bechtel or somebody?
Oh, I don't think we're unless the uncle picks us to do it, and as a job, and federal government finances it, the Corps of Engineers is usually a logical one as an agency that's got engineers in it to do the do a job. But it's whether the federal government's going to finance it that will determine that.
How many engineers, roughly, Army Corps of Engineers are there?
Oh, there must be a couple of hundred.
Okay. Well, during World War II, how many would you say there were? During World War II?
Oh, probably 1,000 anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Who founded the Army Corps of Engineers?
Oh, Lord. Back even in revolutionary days, you needed engineers to do jobs in the Corps of Engineers. I would say that they were established at the beginning of the 18th century, and probably there were some even as early as the 1776 period.
Now, Washington worked as a surveyor, didn't he?
Huh?
George Washington?
Yeah, he was. He was, in some ways, he was He wasn't an engineer, but he got mixed up in surveying. Yes.
Okay, so I guess he could be the father of the Corps.
He could. Yes, that's right.
His birthday's coming next week. Well, General, thank you so much for this interview, and like they say, old soldiers never die. They fade away, but the work you leave behind doesn't.
Yes, and I was very lucky in the Corps of being stationed, and, you know, like getting sent from San Francisco to Chicago to do the Niagara Falls with the Canadians, and we were given a free hand there. I'm very proud of that job.
Did the Canadians put up the same amount of engineers?
They did the work on Canada, and...
Oh, I see.
The boundary goes right through the middle of the Niagara Falls. There's hardly anything. And we each went out the same distance. All of the water was going through the middle of the falls. And all we did was make it. And actually, we made the falls miles long.
Mm-hmm. So you re-engineered nature.
Re-engineered it. And we still made more power. Because water was going through this deep. And we made it go this deep. But it sunk from 1850 to 1900.
What was that model again for the New York soap factory? Good in seawater or something? The model for the model.
Well, it was good in hot, cold, and salt water. And we got one around here somewhere.
Oh, okay.
The end of a box where the soap was.
Oh, I think on your piano.
Yes, on the piano. Yeah, uh-huh. The good in hot, cold, and salt water. And of course. Yeah, you couldn't get fresh water. You've got to appreciate how much rain we don't have now, and putting down wells around here to get fresh water in San Francisco, particularly. So you had to deal with salt water for most things, and trying to get salt water into fresh water was quite a chemical process.
So. Oh, I forgot to ask you about your early life, General. In Boston, what kind of background are you from?
Well, almost. My father was a plumbing contractor, a plumber.
So it's in your blood.
came from Ireland, and he did all the plumbing in the Back Bay.
Of Boston.
Of Boston, you know, and Pekin Street and all those places. He put the plumbing in all these fancy houses. I used to go with him before I was a kid. I remember going around with him at these places where he put in the plumbing.
Mm-hmm.
And... both my brothers were much older. There were three girls between me and the two oldest brothers. And one of them graduated from MIT. The other one was a natural draftsman, and he got out of high school and went as a draftsman for the telephone company. And he was the head of drafting for the telephone company for as long as I could remember. In other words, the telephone company does a lot of drafting.
Right. Did you know any of the politicians like Kennedy's father, Michael Curley?
Curley's, oh yeah. Curley's, oh. The family are very close to the Curleys. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, Irish, you could see in South Boston.
Oh, you're from South Boston?
Yeah. And my mother had a brother who was close to Curley.
Mm-hmm.
And he had political positions.
Uh-huh.
John H. Dunn. Yeah.
And there was you're Roman Catholic, aren't you?
No,
oh, then you must have known the Cardinal at that time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Quite a politician, I understand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You've had quite a background, General.
O'Connell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the end of part two, folks, and then. Since we did talk about military engineers, this week was the birthday, I think Tuesday, oh, he's dead now, of Henry O. Flipper, who was endured one of the worst court-martials in anybody's military history. We've had some awful ones, the Captain Alfred Dreyfus in France, Henry O. Flipper, It was another notorious court-martial case. And, of course, something that's coming up, the Brownsville, Texas, there was a black division down there, a battalion, and there was a race riot or something. I don't have all the facts, but I'll clear, but I will get them. It was during the administration of Teddy Roosevelt, and he had a strange attitude, racist attitude. He used to say, "The plucky little Japs and the Chinese, dirty Chinese." And there was a race riot or something, and he cashiered removed from the army this entire division of blacks, and that's a stain on his administration and his history. Very strange guy. I guess you could call him a Jekyll and Hyde personality. Very accomplished, spoke several languages, was a naturalist, and a big bad hunter. And, of course, these are coming up here in San Francisco, and we have some unusual, very rare recordings and video of the Russo-Japanese War. And, of course, its connection to San Francisco, which is Jack London, who was born here, and will show his birthplace. And he was a correspondent who covered the Russian-Japanese War in 1905. They don't really honor the Russian fleet, the Black Sea Fleet, which is up in the northern part of Russia and of Europe. And when the war broke out, they needed to reinforce Port Arthur, was 5,000 miles on the other side of the world. And so everybody was rooting for the Japanese, but they didn't realize that the British had showed them how to build the navy, and the Germans had trained their army. And so they thought that the Russians were being big bad bullies, the Russian bear, and all that. But the Tsar sent Admiral Radzivetsky on this 5,000-mile circumnavigation of the globe, in effect. And these were cold fuel ships. It was just when the British, and this ties into the British Petroleum, the BP controversy today, the British were switching their ships over to oil, and this is one of the reasons why the British were in the Middle East, because First Lord of the Admiralty, Admiral Jackie Fisher, he was the inventor of the dreadnought, which was the first predecessor of the battleship, and the British needed oil. They switched from coal to oil, and the Russians and some of the other navies hadn't done the conversion, and Radzivetsky didn't get supplies. Everybody hated the Russians and thought they were bullying the Japanese, but somehow they made this trip around the Horn and into the Tsushima Straits, where Admiral Togo, one of the great heroes in Japanese history, was waiting. He was in home waters, and he kept training his ships and the discipline and the loyalty to the emperor. And of all the ships that made it and did battle with the Japanese fleet, Japanese lost, I think, 3 gunboats and about maybe 10 or 100 men killed. The Russians lost all their ships except 2, and they also lost Port Arthur. And Teddy Roosevelt intervened because he couldn't allow a white race, in his view, to be beaten up or defeated by an inferior race, the Japanese. So he convened, in which he got a Nobel Prize, the Peace Conference at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And he was the first president to get the Nobel Peace Prize, and I guess he deserved it for that thing that he did. So tune in next week. We'll have that, and we'll have other more military history. And this is also the week where the Battle of Midway. And we'll go to our YouTube site, Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas. Also, our website's Californians Against Voter Fraud. That's going to be very relevant, very important in the upcoming election. And it's easy to go to all our sites at verzola.com. So, again, this is the best way to end.
Hey, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you 5. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you going to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear.
We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big Ace.
Ace Bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the plan?
I'm in.
Well, I hope we don't pay to the nose in November. For alert, this is Peter Paul Brazola. Tune in Tuesday at 5:30. Thanks for listening, and go to our websites and our YouTube, Amicus Veritas.